Thank you. Please be seated. All right, we're here for oral argument this afternoon. Our case number CV25-0735, FHMC et al. Versus Blue Cross Blue Shield. These proceedings are being video and audio recorded and live streamed, so we ask counsel to please identify yourself and your client at the beginning of your argument. Each side will have 20 minutes. Appellant's counsel is responsible for watching the clock to reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal, if needed or desired. Please keep in mind that we have read the briefs and conferenced the case this afternoon. And with that, counsel, you may begin.
Thank you. May it please the court. I'm Grover Peters. I represent the appellant, Fountain Hills Medical Center, also known as FHMC. Today we're here for three reasons that the trial court erred. First, Blue Cross Blue Shield of Arizona already concedes that the pre-NSA claims survive preemption, federal preemption, but the trial court dismissed them anyway. Second, the savings clause, US 42 USC section 300GG-23A1, expressly preserves the post-NSA state law claims that the trial court never analyzed. And finally, there were about 500 claims that were never processed by Blue Cross Blue Shield of Arizona at all, placing them entirely outside the IDR determination. Now I'll address the pre-NSA claims themselves. There were approximately 71 claims that preceded the NSA, totaling about $467,000 in value. Blue Cross Blue Shield Arizona at the time denied accepting the assignment of benefits that the patients gave to the physicians in this group practice. The case law supports the fact that the assignment of those benefits gave Fountain Hills Medical Center the right to collect the payment from Blue Cross Blue Shield of Arizona. Blue Cross Blue Shield of Arizona continued to pay the patients even though they were aware of the assignment of benefits.
So why is being aware of the assignment enough?
Why isn't being aware
enough? Why is being aware of the assignment enough?
Because
I mean, I'll be more specific with my question. We have case law saying that an indemnity contract, like a health insurance policy, can't be assigned, or the rights under that contract can't be assigned, because, for example, an insurance company usually makes an actuarial decision about who they want to insure, and how much they want the policy payments to be. And that kind of gets upset if the individual could just assign the rights under that contract to another individual or to another company. The right under a contract is different than a claim for maybe breaching the contract. It seems to me like your theory relies on an assignment of the rights under the contract from Blue Cross's insureds to FHMC that you are then trying to exercise.
Not exactly, Your Honor.
Okay.
With respect, you're describing something that's pre-loss versus post-loss. The case that I'm referring to here is Little versus Brown and Bigelow, 40 Arizona 206. In that case,
What is the loss here?
The loss here is that my clients lost the payment for the services they provided. This actually goes to our unjust enrichment argument. Blue Cross Blue Shield of Arizona's patients got the benefit of great health care. They got the benefit of healthy patient population. My emergency room physicians had the detriment of providing all these services and did not get paid. That's the detriment to my clients. And Little versus Brown and Bigelow says, a debtor who pays the assigner after notice does so at their own peril. So there was validity and notice of the assignment.
So do the insureds have a claim against Blue Cross Blue Shield that's been assigned?
The insureds originally had a right for Blue Cross Blue Shield to pay the claim.
See, so now we're back to rights under the contract, not a subsequent claim because Blue Cross Blue Shield didn't do something vis-a-vis the insureds under the contract.
But the insureds had a right to assign that benefit to my clients.
We have case law that says they don't unless Blue Cross Blue Shield consents to that assignment. So did Blue Cross Blue Shield consent to the assignment of rights under their insurance policy from the insureds to FHMC? I didn't see that alleged anywhere in the complaint.
Well, in the case of KB versus State Farm Fire and Casualty Insurance Company, Blue Cross Blue Shield claims the patients have no financial injury, to your point, Your Honor. They're wrong. The patient's right to the proceeds were transferred by assignment. It asserts its own right as an assignee pursuant to KB. So,
right, but again, my question is, did Blue Cross Blue Shield consent to an assignment of the rights under the insurance policy from the insureds to FHMC?
Your Honor, if Blue Cross Blue Shield or any insurance company had to consent to a patient going to see a doctor to assign the right for that doctor to collect payment, then our entire healthcare system would be completely disrupted. It's very, very common for all of us who goes to see a doctor that we sign up when we register for care to say, you can go get my payment from my insurance company. And no one ever asks their insurance company to go give them permission. So I would differ with you and say that it's very common practice in healthcare today for everyone to assign the benefits to the provider who's providing the care. And once that benefit has been assigned, that provider has every expectation of being paid by that insurance company.
Okay, but let's understand your position. Let's say I think consent is required. Did Blue Cross Blue Shield consent to this assignment?
They did not, Your Honor, not in this case. You're welcome, Your Honor. So the core argument we have before you today goes to the post-NSA claims. Those claims were argued that there's no private right of action. We can see that in the federal law, there's no private right of action. But that does not negate the fact that the savings clause says that the federal law should not supersede state law unless, of course, the state law somehow restricts a federal requirement. In these post-NSA claims, they have a duty. Blue Cross Blue Shield of Arizona has a burden to prove that each one of those claims somehow individually restricted a federal requirement. And they haven't done that. In fact, they never even argued it.
In the Superior Court, Blue Cross Blue Shield also just moved to dismiss under 12b-6 for failure to state a claim, right?
They did, Your Honor.
Okay, and then in their answering brief on appeal, they again make the arguments why FHMC's claims fail under Arizona law, regardless of preemption, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
And you didn't address those arguments in your briefing, right?
Not specifically, Your Honor.
Okay.
But by implication, the Loper-Bright case says that the court has a duty to do the best reading of the statutory text. And at the time of the Superior Court case, the savings clause was in effect, and they had a duty to go ahead and determine, did any one of those state claims that we're alleging somehow restrict a federal requirement? And that was never done. They never thought about it. They never interpreted it. They never analyzed it. They never even discussed it.
I think that's a response on the preemption issue, but I think what Judge Catlett was getting at, and we were just kind of nailed down, is the alternative argument, which is the 12b-6 dismissal on the merits of each claim. Did you state a claim under your, I think it's 11 separate state claims? Your colleague raised that issue below and then raised it again in the appellate briefing. Did you respond to that in your briefing?
We did not, Your Honor.
Okay.
But in all of the claims that you're referring to, every one of those claims had an alternative legal theory that we could put with that particular claim. The problem that we have in general with the trial court decision was it did conflict preemption on everything. So we already know that that didn't apply to the pre-NSA claims. We already know that they never looked at the savings clause and never thought about the savings clause and what it meant to each individual specific claim. But more importantly, there were over 500 claims that never made it to the IDR process at all. They were never processed. They were never considered. They were just completely ignored. And that goes to our bad faith argument. It was an intentional act on the part of Blue Cross Blue Shield to not do anything with those 500 claims. And because of that, my clients had no ability to even pursue their benefit underneath the IDR process.
You cite Coleman versus City of Mesa. It's a 2012 Arizona Supreme Court case for the proposition that when a trial court dismisses all claims on a single threshold ground, appellants need not brief every claim's merits to preserve them. Do you remember?
Yes, Your Honor.
I mean, you cite to page 373 or 363 of Coleman, and I took a look at that page, and I'm not seeing that proposition is discussed anywhere in that case. So can you help me with that?
My apologies, Your Honor, I don't have that case with me today, okay. And I don't have immediate recall to that. So.
Okay. Did you use generative AI to assist with your brief?
No. Okay. No, Your Honor. I've read enough information about that, would not ever consider that.
Okay. Because we have a bunch of citations to Lexis Reporter that when we put into Lexis, we can't find those cases at that citation. Do you know what's going on with that?
I do not, Your Honor. I use LexisNexis, and LexisNexis does have an AI component, to your point, called Protégé, that's a part of LexisNexis, but that's the only thing that may have been AI-generated in the process of doing the claims research or case research.
So you use that AI tool?
We use LexisNexis Protégé, yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
It appears even the federal case, the federal court case, has the incorrect site as well.
Which case is that, Your Honor?
Your case
where you started.
In federal court, it appears to have an accurate site as well.
In other words, your reference in front of us to your own case in the federal court used the wrong citation.
I have no explanation for that, Your Honor.
Okay.
Did you check the citations?
We did, Your Honor.
Filing the brief?
We did, Your Honor. And it's been a while.
I guess why should we go down the preemption route if there's not a valid claim under Arizona law among those 11 that you tried to plead?
Well, again, under the preemption concept, instead of conflict preemption being applied across the board, we need to look at the savings clause and each one of those claims has a right to determine did it somehow restrict a federal requirement. We don't know if it did or didn't because that was never done. Nobody ever thought about it, they didn't talk about it, didn't analyze it. And savings clause is clear. It simply says that federal law cannot supersede state law unless there's a specific exception or requirement that needs to be met.
Would you agree with me that we could affirm a dismissal for any reason, including on the alternative theory that you failed to state a claim under the state law grounds?
I would agree with you, Your
Honor. If we were to find that. So, for the sake of this, just hypothetically, let's assume we agreed with you and there's no federal preemption. But then we need to look at those 12B6 grounds as to each of your state law claims, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
And I'm looking at the federal statute that you're referring to, the savings clause, and it says that basically the NSA shall not be construed to supersede any provision of state law which establishes, implements, or continues in effect any standard or requirement solely relating to health insurance issuers in connection with individual or group health insurance. And my question is, how does a common law breach of contract claim or an unjust enrichment claim relate to health insurance issuers in connection with individual or group health insurance coverage?
How does a common law claim relate to this? I apologize, Your Honor. Could you restate that?
The way I read this, the savings clause only kicks in if the state has a standard or requirement solely relating to health insurance issuers. That is what is not being preempted. And I'm wondering, you're saying, well, your common law claims are not preempted. And I'm wondering how because of the savings clause, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And I'm wondering how those common law claims solely relate to health insurance issuers in connection with individual or group health insurance.
Because the post-NSA claims we're speaking about were insurance claims made by a healthcare provider to an insurance company. And those claims, by pursuant to the rule, says that each individual claim must be evaluated to determine did that somehow restrict that federal requirement. And if not, then it's entitled to being to the provision that says that the federal law cannot supersede the state law. And Arizona state law allows these claims to be processed.
I guess another way to put it is anyone in Arizona who thinks that they have a contract with another person that has been breached can bring a common law claim for breach of contract. The way I read the savings clause, or one way to read it, is that this doesn't apply to that situation because The common law breach of contract claim is not limited to just claims between health, or relating to health insurance.
Your Honor, you keep referring to breach of contract claim, and so I differ with that analysis. This isn't really about a breach of contract issue. This is more about the fact that the law says those individual claims in that pre-NSA or that post-NSA bunch of claims, not the 500 that never got processed, but just the middle group of claims, had a right to be evaluated to determine if they caused any problems to the federal law or not. The federal law, that as it's being described by Blue Cross Blue Shield of Arizona, they're trying to put a ceiling on it. And if they prevail with that, then nobody will ever have any remedy at the state level. No provider will ever be able to argue that they're not properly paid. The savings clause builds on top of the federal law. So there's a floor to ceiling concept. So we're not talking about a breach of contract issue as much as the fact that there's a duty to evaluate these claims to determine if they're valid or not. And that never happened. Your Honor, I see that my time has run. At the beginning, I asked to reserve 5 minutes. I've got 4 minutes and 40 seconds. I'd like to reserve that time for rebuttal, if I may.
Yep, absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Randy Papetti. I represent the appellee Blue Cross Blue Shield in this matter. I'd like to begin with what we've been calling the post-NSA claims, which the trial court dismissed on preemption grounds. I'll then turn to the pre-NSA claims. With respect to the post-NSA claims, I'd like to use my time to do three things. First, I'd like to just zoom out just a little bit and make sure that it's clear what precisely the appellees are asking this court ultimately to hold as a practical matter, because it would be unprecedented and totally unsupported. Second, I'd like to correct an oversight in our papers and discuss the statute that appellants now rely on so heavily, the savings clause or the preemption clause. I think I can clear up pretty quickly, given the feedback that's happened thus far, as to why that statute's inapplicable. And third, I'd like to spend some time discussing why the trial court got it exactly right on this issue of complete preemption. So in late 2020, Congress passed the No Surprises Act. It became effective in early 2022. And among other things, it created a new public right for out-of-network providers to receive reimbursement directly from insurers. Being out-of-network, they historically did not have any right, at least in Arizona, directly against insurers. And this was a new right in Arizona.
Previously, they'd have to go against the patient who received the payment from the insurance company?
100%. Okay. Yeah. Now, under the NSA, out-of-network providers are entitled to receive what the statute refers to as the out-of-network rate, which the statute then defines in subsection 111A3K. It's a lovely statute to work with, as you may have observed. Congress defined what out-of-network rate means and how it's determined. And it says, first, if you have a state-specified law, that's the term that's used, that deals with this issue, because some states already did have sort of no surprises, many no surprises acts. If you have that kind of law in the books, that state law for determining what the out-of-network rate shall be, that controls. If you don't have it, you're kicked into the IDR, or independent dispute resolution process, established by the Act. And so on the one hand, the Act gave out-of-network providers this new right, but at the same time, it set up a process that some of the out-of-network providers now don't like very much, sort of the bitter with the sweet, but they're tied together. It was a balance that Congress crafted to try and solve a complex issue. Against that backdrop, appellees now want to bring 1,400, at least, because the spreadsheet is more, but at least 1,479 claims into court on close to a dozen different theories, all of which directly or indirectly relate to them enforcing what they view as their rights and benefits under the NSA. Now, there's an argument that could be made, has been made in this case, rejected in the trial court, implicitly rejected elsewhere, that maybe the IDR process is an opt-in process. You don't have to opt in to the No Surprises Act. You can ignore it and go your own way. That's a losing argument. The trial court rejected it. But what no court would support is what's attempted here, which is to rely on the rights and benefits in the act, but seek to supplement them with a whole bunch of state law damages, interests, rights, and other remedies under state law. Even the people hypothesizing about, well, maybe you can opt out of the NSA and just go do your own common law claims. Nobody is suggesting you can do both these things in the same case, and one can understand why. There'd be thousands of these cases, and which parts of the IDR process can be challenged or rejected or supplemented. And that's especially true given that the act itself states that it's subject to very little judicial review. So now I'd like to just talk briefly about what's been referred to as the savings statute. There isn't a whole lot to say, because if you read the text, it very clearly is designed to just preserve some semblance of state's ability to regulate in this area. Historically, insurance regulation was a state law issue. Starting in the mid-90s, the federal government started becoming much more involved in passing major laws concerning healthcare and healthcare insurance. That statute was passed in 1996 as part of the Public Health Services Act. It was later said to encompass the Affordable Care Act in 2010, and now it applies to the No Surprises Act and some other legislation. But on its face, it applies to any provision of state law, which is no one would view a common law claim as a provision of state law. And certainly, if it has to apply solely to the healthcare insurance, it doesn't cover it. But what's just as applicable is the last clause in that statute, basically is legislative's language referring to the doctrine of conflict preemption. So even if the statute applied, it still leaves open the issue of, if conflict preemption applies, you wouldn't apply it anyway. So the statute's essentially irrelevant and just winds everybody back to the conflict preemption issue.
What if, I think maybe this relates to the first topic you were talking about, not the savings clause, but what if FHMC, and I don't think this is an allegation in this case, but I'm just trying to play things out a bit. What if they thought that your client had somehow committed fraud during the NSA ADR process? Is it your position that they couldn't then bring a state common law fraud claim for that? I mean, they do have a consumer fraud claim, I guess, and that's, I also kind of struggle with that being conflict preemption.
Let me start with the first part, Judge. The statute provides limited grounds upon which you can seek vacature of the award. It refers to Section 10 of the FAA in the statute, which includes one of the four grounds is for fraud. The award is procured by fraud. So there is a remedy in the statute that talks about it, is what you're talking about, if there was fraud in the process. And there are allegations in at least one other case, and certainly a suggestion that Blue Cross gave false information or bad information to the RDR people. I would submit that that's squarely within the scope of administrative enforcement. If that kind of thing is happening, this type of thing you could complain about to the regulators. But at a minimum, if an award is procured by fraud, you have a remedy right in the statute.
But I guess, does it conflict with the federal statute or make the federal statute unworkable if they can go to state court and sue your client for fraud, separate and apart from whatever they may have ended up getting paid under the ADR process, but because they were somehow separately injured because of false statements that were made?
I don't know about separate injury. I'd have to think about through what that would be here, but I would submit to Your Honor that this idea of supplementing remedies that may be consistent or not necessarily inconsistent with something, the doctrine of preemption here goes further than that. The idea is not that we're going to bounce back and forth and determine on any particular claim whether it would hurt the grounds. For example, the courts have said you can't bring an action to enforce the provisions of the act. Nothing could be more consistent with the act than an action to enforce the provisions of the act. So I would think that something going beyond that would invoke the doctrine, just consistent with what we've been talking about. I hope that answered your question.
I mean, I guess our Supreme Court, at least, seems fairly skeptical of things like conflict preemption. They said in 2022 that we presume federal lawmakers do not cavalierly preempt state law because the states are independent sovereigns in our federal system and have historically had great latitude to protect the lives, limbs, health, comfort, and quiet of their citizens. And it also said, this is the Varela v. FCA case, that our Supreme Court says state law is preempted not by what is expressed in federal law, but rather by what may be implied by federal law.
Yeah.
And it almost seems like they've created sort of a presumption against finding things like conflict preemption.
Well, we're not strutting in here saying it should be presumed.
Right.
On the other hand, we need to understand what we're talking about here. This is the creation of a federal statute providing a new right and claims that the statute is being dishonored, that Blue Cross is not participating in good faith, that Blue Cross is not timely paying claims under the statute. These claims that we're saying fall within the doctrine of conflict preemption. Forget about the labels of the causes of action. These claims all relate to one way or another enforcing or trying to supplement rights under the statute. So we're not talking about Congress coming in and saying, oh, like in some of those ERISA cases you used to see, someone would get hurt and they'd say, oh, the preemption. We're not really talking about that here. This is much narrower than the concern I think the Supreme Court may have had. And of course, this is a matter of federal law, ultimately.
Right. I was going to say, maybe it doesn't matter what our Supreme Court says.
Now, well, I didn't say that.
I know you didn't. I'm not saying it expressly. Yeah, though. Yeah, I am. What matters is what the U.S. Supreme Court thinks when it comes to preemption, right?
I think so. And I think the Astra case and the Arizona versus United States cases that we cited have language that I think applies pretty clearly here. It would be incompatible to funnel these kinds of issues by the thousands into state court to try and figure out how we're going to use that state court process to enforce the act. I'm not going to go through all the separate grounds. I think the trial court's reasoning on the doctrine of conflict preemption, part of which he borrowed from the federal court's dismissal of the original complaint in this matter, I think was very sound. I think the citations, like I said, to the Astra and Grachowski case about, you know, we're not even going to get into specifically enforcement issues when we see that there's an administrative framework that's been created here where there's no federal private right of action. As we said in our papers, we didn't mean to be flippant, but it's a bit dubious that there would be no federal right to enforce this federal statute, federal judicial right to enforce this statute, but there would be a state right under generic state law causes of action and generic state law statutes. That would be quite a stretch to assume that that's within the scope of what Congress intended. On this issue of...
Sorry, you heard me ask counsel about the ability to assign the rights under an indemnity insurance policy, like a health insurance policy. My understanding is you can't... Our state law says you can't do that unless, I guess in this case, Blue Cross Blue Shield had consented.
Yeah, so Blue Cross didn't consent. There's nothing in the record indicate Bruce Cutt consented. But I think there's even something more fundamental with respect to the assignment issue, and it would explain the trial court's analysis. First, the trial court did not rely on preemption in getting rid of the pre-NSA claims. That's not in the order. That wasn't our argument either. There'd be no ability to claim preemption if it came before the statute was enacted. But the more fundamental point I'd like to make is this. If you look at the actual assignment in this case, it's at appendix page 44. The actual assignment in this case is part of a larger document, multi-page document, that patients sign when they go to FHMC. It includes several different kinds of provisions and promises. One of the promises, by the way, is if you get a check from your insurer, you owe it to us. So obviously that's a thing that happens, but it's not some standalone assignment document. If you review carefully what's in the trial court record, as opposed to what's implied certainly in the reply brief here and to a lesser extent the motion, there is no direct allegation that these assignments were even provided to Blue Cross prior to it paying its insurance the money. Their statements that they were aware of their practice of having assignments, their statements that it's industry practice for providers to be paid directly. They say it can be presumed that Blue Cross knew about it. They point to the fact that Blue Cross on occasion did pay them on some claims directly. But for each of these 71 claims that comprise this $467,000, not for one of them, and certainly not for all of them, is there an allegation that the assignments were given and received, let alone consented to by Blue Cross prior to the payments going out. Which is why the trial court and we analyzed the issue as, okay, well, we see them now, without even getting into their validity, we see them, let's assume it, there's no rights left to cash in with Blue Cross, okay? So no, there was no consent. No, there's no direct allegation that these were given and received by Blue Cross prior to the time that it paid its insurance. The last point I want to make is on Your Honor's raising the issue with respect to, you know, can you affirm the trial court even if you don't reach the preemption issue? If the court believes it can do so, then yes, avoiding commenting on federal law is certainly permissible. I think the preemption analysis is very strong on the issue. So if you do not feel that you're able to dismiss entirely on independent state law grounds, I do believe that we clearly win on the preemption issue. This is a careful balance that Congress was trying to create. It's been problematic, as their supplemental authority pointed out. Insurers and everybody is struggling to get everything just right. But these don't belong in court. You know, efforts to enforce that statute don't belong to court.
Why wouldn't Congress have included an express preemption provision?
Well, I think there are two reasons, I suspect. One, I think that Congress was being very careful not to preempt state regulatory authority. So if you look at both Section 23A, 300GG-23A, which is the saving statute that they pointed out, there's a statute right before that, 300GG-22A. Both of those are designed to make clear that if you have state regulatory issues, we're not meaning to touch those unless they're incompatible. On this issue of state common law claims, I don't know exactly what they would have said. You know, they said judicial review is limited to these four circumstances. The federal court said they certainly didn't mean to imply a federal cause of action. These kinds of issues are not generally resolved, certainly in Arizona, were not generally resolved via unjust enrichment claims, consumer fraud claims. I don't know that Congress had it in their mind that this was going to be a problem.
Is there any right to judicial review following the ADR process?
Yes, okay. Very limited. It invokes references four grounds under Section 10 of the FAA to vacate an award if it's improper. But multiple courts have construed Congress's intent to leave judicial review so narrow that they've rejected the idea that there's any right to judicial review to enforce an award. The Guardian Flight case in the Fifth Circuit that went up with other cases to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court denied cert, says that expressly. The Modern Orthopedics case we cited says that expressly. Congress said you can vacate the award on four grounds.
So you are the healthcare provider, you get an award, the insurance company refuses to pay, you're out of luck?
Well, I don't think you're intended to be out of luck. I think you're supposed to call CMS or submit the forms or do any of the things that the statute contemplates. The statute also contemplates in some circumstances the state regulators can be involved. I think the statute is assuming a certain amount of good faith by the insurance companies. The statute probably doesn't work well over time if there's not a certain amount of good faith by the insurance companies. But on the other hand, the statute didn't provide for everybody just to come in and start suing.
What are the four grounds you mentioned?
Oh, boy. Yeah. One's fraud, procured by fraud. I just don't know all four grounds. I apologize. They are set forth, and they're in Section 10 of the FAA, the Federal Arbitration Act. But they're grounds to vacate an award.
Yeah, those would be the general grounds that it would apply
yes.
At the end of any arbitration process.
Correct.
Right, yeah.
Correct. The Arizona statute's very similar.
Yeah.
Okay. Do your honors have any additional questions for me?
No, thank you.
Thank you.
Just a few points, Your Honor. As it relates to the Guardian case that he just referenced, in that case, Guardian never analyzed 42 U.S.C. 300GG-2381, known as the Savings Clause. The Fifth Circuit's holding that Congress did not create federal judicial remedies is consistent with Congress's separate commanding that the federal law shall not be construed to supersede state law. So there's two questions. Did Congress create a federal remedy? And the answer is no. Did Congress preserve a state remedy? The answer is yes, based upon the statute. The Savings Clause, 300-2381, was written at the same time as the IDR rule was written. If Congress intended for that Savings Clause not to apply to state remedies, they would have said so, but they did not do so. They were more narrow in their requirements under 300-GG-111 in that case. That one sets payment methodology. And counsel just a moment ago mentioned that the law, and he admitted, says that there should be an out-of-network rate of reimbursement. The problem is that because there's the final IDR rule that came out on May 20, 2 days before this argument, said there's over 5 million disputes currently before CMS. And the problem is that that out-of-network rate isn't being calculated properly. The QPA is not being calculated properly. These providers are being paid at in-network rates or less, 80% of Medicare rates. That's been part of the problem. Now, going back to your point you mentioned a minute ago, Your Honor, the U.S. Supreme Court in Medtronic versus Laura says savings clauses in federal statutes are construed to preserve state authority, not eliminate it. In the United States Supreme Court's Kentucky Association versus Miller, 538 U.S. 329, state laws regulating insurance not preempted by ERISA fall within ERISA's savings clause. Savings clauses preserve state insurance law. So I'm going to end and just say that if there's no state remedy available to these providers, then the insurance companies can set the ceiling up and there will never be an opportunity to get correct remedy for the lack of payment on these claims. My clients are out.
Do you agree with counsel's, I guess, interpretation of the Fifth Circuit case, that it means your client gets an award, it doesn't have any way to enforce it if Blue Cross Blue Shield decides not to pay on the award?
I agree, Your Honor. In the post-NSA claims that we're talking about,
yeah,
there are many IDR awards that have already been granted by the entity that heard the award that haven't been paid. And there's no enforcement. And my clients have no ability. They're struggling to say, how do I get our money? They don't pay me next month, next year. When are they going to pay me? Because of that final rule that came out on May 28th.
And why can't your client go to CMS and complain about Blue Cross Blue Shield?
They could, but the fact of the matter is the Department of Justice and the General Accounting Office have both said that this is just untenable, that it can't work. Because with the 5 million plus disputes that's before the system now.
What's untenable, the NSA process?
The whole process of trying to because the rule was so poorly written, the doctors have all been complaining and complaining and complaining, and now 5 million plus disputes in that final rule issued 2 days ago documents the fact that this is not working, and there's a problem. And to argue that somehow
is that a problem for Congress?
It is absolutely a problem for Congress, and that's why they're revisiting the Independent Dispute Resolution Enforcement Act that's currently before Congress. I believe it's Senate Bill 5535, if I'm correct. Please don't quote me on that, but I think I'm pretty close to that.
How does that problem tie into your argument that healthcare providers should be able to bring common law claims in state courts against insurance?
Because the Arizona law in the Savings Clause says that those claims are not in any way restricting a federal requirement. We're asking the state to take a look at the Savings Clause and use Loper in terms of the best reading of the statutory and say this is what the law says for the state of Arizona, not the federal law, not the federal case, and don't put a ceiling on it. Their rule is a floor, and the state of Arizona has the right to build on that floor and to protect the providers that are working in this state. So we're asking the court to reverse and remand this case back.
Thank you. All right. Thank you, counsel, for your helpful argument and briefing in the case. We will take the matter under advisement and get you a decision in due course. Thank you.